This week, we explore the question, do the Shriners have any connection to mystic Islam? What do we know about the origin of the Shriners, of Walter Fleming and William Florence? Where did they get these degrees? And what prompted them to create the Shriners? Then, we'll dive into a world of ancient mysteries and secret societies that have influenced modern Masonic symbolism. In a three-part series that was excerpted from Banley P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages, we explore Mithraism, Druidism, and other sacred rites in the typical poetic and etheric style of one Banley P. Hall. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 595. I want to thank our supporters. Whether you support us through Patreon or through PayPal, we can't do this show without you. You make all of it possible, and you have our eternal thanks. If you're interested in how you can assist the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. We have contributor levels, fellow levels, producer levels, and even a legacy partner that allows you to work with me directly and direct an episode annually. You can also make a one-time gift to the show, which is also very helpful. And if none of that works for you, please just consider sharing and liking and subscribing and all of those things with your Lodge brothers. Share the episodes if you find one that is in particular meaningful or answers a question that you had with a candidate. Share the show with them. We'll be eternally grateful. Other ways you can help support the show, if you're looking to do some shopping, we do have our shop, which has some limited edition items, including signed editions of books that I've either wrote or co-wrote. And of course, we also have an Amazon bookstore. In the news, my next presentation is going to be out at Wallkill Lodge in New York. After that, I'll be in Battle Creek, Michigan. And then after that, I'll be in Manassas 182 for a festive board, delivering a keynote over or after dinner, likely, with our good friend, Brother Joe Martinez of the Masonic Roundtable. So it's very exciting. Month, Masonically, very busy. I'm hoping all of you are staying busy and healthy. And with all of that out of the way, I'd like to begin our education this week by reading an article that was published by Brother Jonathan Dinsmore, who is an Entered Apprentice. And he published it. I don't think he's an Entered Apprentice anymore. But nonetheless, he did some good research for his lodge. And this was published in April of 2019. And his article is entitled, Do the Shriners Connect Freemasonry to Islam? Now, we have in the past read articles on the history of the shrine, and these were very interesting, and it talked about the founders and the play that they saw, and when they came over, they try to emulate this play, but let's see what Brother Jonathan Dinsmore's take on the situation is. Does the ancient Arabic order of the nobles of the mystic shrine connect Freemasonry with mystical Islam? Who are the Shriners? How are they related to Freemasonry, and do they connect Freemasonry to Islam in some way? While most believe the Shriners, or ancient Arabic order of the nobles of the mystic shrine, to be merely a Masonic club where Masons get together outside the regular lodge to have fun and do some charity work, is there actually a more mysterious history to the organization beneath the surface level? Today we'll learn a few things about the Shriners and their origins, and investigate whether they truly connect Freemasonry to Islam. One of the things that Shriners are best known for is being an organization in which Freemasons cut loose a bit, engage in socializing, convene and organize for celebrations or pursuit of various hobbies. One does have to be a Master Mason to become a Shriner, although the shrine itself does not represent a new or different degree within the Scottish Rite or York Rite degrees. Each Shriner temple, often decorated in Middle Eastern style, draws Masons from a wide area, as they are fewer and further between than Masonic temples are. Thus, these buildings are places where Masons from the surrounding region convene, and are somewhat more like convention centers than a typical temple. Each contains clubs or units within it, which are related to various hobbies or activities that Masons may take an interest in, ranging from chess clubs to motorcycle groups. Shriners also engage in fundraising activities for charity and organizing lively parades. Formed in 1872, the Shriners are a self-described spin-off of Freemasonry, with an added element of fun and philanthropy. The conventional story of Shriner origins goes that the organization was created by Walter M. Fleming and William J. Florence. This was after Florence, an actor on tour, was initiated by an Arabian diplomat at a party in France, by virtue of being a member of the audience of a performance the diplomat had organized. Later, Florence and Fleming combined elements they had learned from Masonry with what Florence had seen from the performance at the party, and created the ancient Arabic order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. The organization grew from there, eventually becoming what it is today. Of course, like anything connected to Freemasonry or any other secret society, there are Shriner conspiracy theorists, usually of the fundamentalist variety, which believe otherwise. These conspiracists base their arguments on the usual leaps to conclusions and sporadic dot connecting that we're accustomed to seeing from that crowd. They seem to think that the organization is connected to the religion of Islam tracing back to the first millennium AD. While it is true there is some Islam-related symbolism in Shriner regalia, not least of which some variations of their signature fez including the word Mecca, there is no firmly established historical evidence tying the Shriners to Islam. Indeed, it would be difficult to adopt an Arabic aesthetic without some elements of Islam cropping up. The fez itself long predates Shriners, originating in Morocco, perhaps, as far back as the 900s AD, and was merely adopted by the Shriners. However, as we saw in the standard origin narrative, it did begin with an initiation of two masters into a secret society by an Arabian diplomat. Although this seemed to be a simple party initiation of not much consequence, something like, "You've seen the play, now I declare you members," at least from the story handed down to us. However, is that really the case? What was the organization they were initiated into that began this fraternal spin-off? I have not been able to find any information on the diplomat, or even the name of the organization. However, some Shriner sources do mention that Brother Florence got his inspiration for the Shriner aesthetic not just from that party in France, but also from attending two more ceremonies, presumably of the same organization, in Algiers and Cairo. I suppose we could speculate, without much evidence, but what would be the point? There are no clear and concrete indications of the Shriners' connection to Islam that I could find, only conspiratorial suppositions based primarily on the icons they use, and a mysterious question mark as to the organization that originally initiated them, via the Arabian diplomat. Is there more to be found here? Perhaps. But until then, I'm not convinced that there is a connection. Brother Jonathan Dinsmore, First Degree. I love this. He takes just the facts, brings them together, and at the end of it, he's just not convinced. And I like this because he has chosen to not bring in the baloney that we find on these conspiratorial websites. A+, I think, on this Lodge education piece. I think the information that is most significant from this, that our mystery seekers out there, such as myself, might find ourselves digging into the books around, is this diplomat and this original play, and perhaps two other plays, presumably of that same organization, he says, that happened in Algiers and in Cairo. Now, if we could find those, that would be something special. Are you a member of the Shrine? I'd love to hear about your thoughts on the Shrine, not necessarily about its charity. We all know about this charity thing. Heard that there are several different versions of the initiations, going from the cold sands to the hot sands. I've seen old electric chair things, and I've heard rumors of ice cream and stuff like this. In the Craftsman Plus group, keep in mind there are non-members of Shriners and even non-members of Masonry who are members in that group. But please, feel free to share your experience and your thoughts about any of this mystery origins of the Shriners, and perhaps any links to information you may have found that could solve the mystery. Of course, we're talking about the Craftsman Plus group. So I hope to see some great conversation and maybe a little bit of conspiracy there. We'll see. Next up, I'd like to read a three-part series that was published on a website in three parts. However, the three parts are actually written by Manly P. Hall. It's a series of one chunk of secret teachings of all ages. Let's first premise this particular three-part series. We're going to read it all right now. It's not that long. However, let's preface this with some information about Manly Hall. Manly P. Hall, a product of the early 20th century, in particular spiritualism, theosophy, and various other esoteric orders. Hall was a prolific in his thoughts about all things spiritualism, esoteric, you name it. The Philosophical Research Society, which is located out in California, the PRS.org, if you're curious, is his home, or was his home, and lecture hall. And today they have a bookstore and a lecture series hall, and it's a whole awesome place. If you can go there and organize a visit, I highly recommend it. Make sure they're open. But Manly Hall is considered by so many Freemasons today to be amazing, and I don't disagree. I also feel that Manly P. Hall is, and I mean this in the kindest way, overrated by some of our younger esoteric students. Manly P. Hall was not a Mason until later in life. I shouldn't say later, but quite a ways after the publication of his, what is considered a magnum opus, his great work, which is Secret Teachings of All Ages, as it's known primarily. When he wrote this and worked with Knapp on all of the images, Hall was not a Mason at the time. In fact, I think he was made a Mason at sight by Brother Henry Clausen, 33rd degree, who I do have great reverence for, but also is of the same philosophical bent as Manly P. Hall. Now, I should say that Manly P. Hall, anything he writes about, should be taken with not a grain of sand, but with an air of caution that what he writes about and how he writes, there is not generally a source behind these things. These are his own writings and suppositions that he has come up with through his various studies. And if you've seen his library, you know, I'm sure he's read many of the books there or parts of all the books there, but it's impossible most of us. I mean, you've all seen probably my library in my house, in my office, and have determined that there's just no way I could have read all of the books that I have. And that is a true statement. I cannot read all of these books. I probably couldn't read all these books in a lifetime. But I do read parts of them as I need to. And I have a love of books, as so did Manly Hall. Now, Hall had an extensive knowledge of a lot of these things. And he is an amazing man, Freemason. And so when we talk about Manly P. Hall, we should understand that the man is a prolific, super intellectual individual, but that everything that we read has an element of poetic license. It has an element of Manly P. Hall's sort of automatic writing of what he envisioned in his mind at the time he is writing these articles for his magnum opus. The man was a sort of esoteric savant, but again, not unlike Eliphas Levi, not unlike perhaps Albert Pike, you're not going to get a series of references, citations, a bibliography, nothing will come through that in Secret Teachings of All Ages. So you must take it from the man and trust it or not, or somewhere in between. And I think the best way to approach Manly P. Hall is to read it and then to enjoy it and to take the parts that I think resonate with you and to meditate on those, to think about them and to find further connections. Perhaps you'll connect some more dots or verify or prove something to the contrary. So with all that disclaimer and upfront information, let's read Ancient Mysteries and Secret Societies Which Have Influenced Modern Masonic Symbolism, Part 1, by Brother Manly P. Hall. The first part in a series of articles, taken from Manly P. Hall's magnum opus, The Secret Teachings of All Ages About the Ancient Influences Upon Modern Masonry, describes the origin of our craft as they can be found in the mystic history of the world of antiquity. When confronted with a problem involving the use of the reasoning faculties, individuals of strong intellect keep their poise and seek to reach a solution by obtaining facts bearing upon the question. Those of immature mentality, on the other hand, when similarly confronted, are overwhelmed. While the former may be qualified to solve the riddle of their own destiny, the latter must be led like a flock of sheep and taught in simple language. They depend almost entirely upon the ministrations of the shepherd. The Apostle Paul said that these little ones must be fed with milk, but that meat is the food of strong men. Thoughtlessness is almost synonymous with childness, while thoughtfulness is symbolic of maturity. There are, however, but few mature minds in the world, and thus it was that the philosophic religious doctrines of the pagans were divided to meet the needs of these two fundamental groups of human intellect, one philosophic, the other incapable of appreciating the deeper mysteries of life. To the discerning few were revealed the esoteric or spiritual teachings, while the unqualified many received only the literal or exoteric interpretations. In order to make simple the great truths of nature and the abstract principles of natural law, the vital forces of the universe were personified, becoming the gods and goddesses of the ancient mythologies. While the ignorant multitudes brought their offerings to the altars of Priapus and Pan, deities representing the procreative energies, the wise recognized in these marble statues only symbolic concretions of great abstract truths. In all cities of the ancient world were temples for public worship and offering. In every community also were philosophers and mystics, deeply versed in nature's lore. These individuals were usually banded together, forming seclusive, philosophic, and religious schools. The more important of these groups were known as the Mysteries. Many of the great minds of antiquity were initiated into these secret fraternities by strange and mysterious rites, some of which were extremely cruel. Alexander Wilder defines the Mysteries as quote-unquote sacred dramas performed at stated periods. The most celebrated were those of Isis, Sabazius, Sibyl, and Eleusis, end quote. After being admitted, the initiates were instructed in the secret wisdom which had been preserved for ages. Plato, an initiate of one of these sacred orders, was severely criticized because in his writings he revealed to the public many of the secret philosophic principles of the Mysteries. Every pagan nation had, and has, not only its state religion, but another, into which the philosophic elect alone have gained entrance. Many of these ancient cults vanished from the earth without revealing their secrets, but a few have survived the test of ages, and their mysterious symbols are still preserved. Much of the ritualism of Freemasonry is based on the trials to which candidates were subjected by the ancient hierophants before the keys of wisdom were entrusted to them. Few realize the extent to which the ancient secret schools influenced contemporary intellects and, through those minds, posterity. Robert McCoy, 33rd degree, in his General History of Freemasonry, pays a magnificent tribute to the part played by the ancient mysteries in the rearing of the edifice of human culture. He says in part, quote, "It appears that all the perfection of civilization and all the advancement made in philosophy, science, and art among the ancients are due to those institutions which under the veil of mystery sought to illustrate the sublimest truths of religion, morality, and virtue, and impress them on the hearts of their disciples." Their chief object was to teach the doctrine of one God, the resurrection of man to eternal life, the dignity of the human soul, and to lead the people to see the shadow of the deity in the beauty, magnificence, and splendor of the universe. With a decline of virtue, which has preceded the destruction of every nation of history, the mysteries became perverted. Sorcery took the place of divine magic. Indescribable practices such as the Bacchanalia were introduced, and the perversion ruled supreme. For no institution can be any better than the members of which it is composed. In despair, the few who were true sought to preserve the secret doctrines from oblivion. In some cases they succeeded, but more often the arcanum was lost, and only the empty shell of the mysteries remained. Thomas Taylor has written, "Man is naturally a religious animal. From the earliest dawning of his consciousness, man has worshipped and revered things as symbolic of the invisible, omnipresent, indescribable thing concerning which he could discover practically nothing. The pagan mysteries opposed the Christians during the early centuries of their church, declaring that the new faith, Christianity, did not demand virtue and integrity as requisites for salvation." Celsus expressed himself on the subject in the following caustic terms, quote, "That I do not, however, accuse the Christians more bitterly than truth compels, may be conjectured from hence, that the criers who call men to other mysteries proclaim as follows, let him approach whose hands are pure and whose words are wise. And again others proclaim, let him approach who is pure from all wickedness, whose soul is not conscious of any evil, and who leads a just and upright life. And these things are proclaimed by those who promise a purification from error. Let us now hear who those are that are called to the Christian mysteries. Whosoever is a sinner, whoever is unwise, whoever is a fool, and whoever, in short, is miserable, him the kingdom of God will receive. Do you not therefore call a sinner, an unjust man, a thief, a housebreaker, a wizard, one who is sacrilegious, and a robber of sepulchres? What other persons would the crier nominate who should call robbers together?" End quote. It was not the true faith of the early Christian mystics that Celsus attacked, but the false forms that were creeping in even during his day. The ideals of early Christianity were based upon the high moral standards of the pagan mysteries, and the first Christians who met under the city of Rome used as their places of worship the subterranean temples of Mithras, from whose cult has been borrowed much of the sacerdotalism of the modern church. The ancient philosophers believed that no man could live intelligently who did not have a fundamental knowledge of nature and her laws. Before man can obey, he must understand, and the mysteries were devoted to instructing man concerning the operation of divine law in the terrestrial sphere. Few of the early cults actually worshipped anthropomorphic deities, although their symbolism might lead one to believe they did. They were moralistic rather than religionistic, philosophic rather than theologic. They taught man to use his faculties more intelligently, to be patient in the face of adversity, to be courageous when confronted by danger, to be true in the midst of temptation, and most of all, to view a worthy life as the most acceptable sacrifice to God, and his body as an altar sacred to deity. Sun worship played an important part in nearly all the early pagan mysteries. This indicates the probability of their Atlantean origin, for the people of Atlantis were sun worshippers. The solar deity was usually personified as a beautiful youth with long golden hair to symbolize the rays of the sun. The golden sun god was slain by wicked ruffians who personified the evil principle of the universe. By means of certain rituals and ceremonies symbolic of purification and regeneration, this wonderful god of good was brought back to life and became the savior of his people. The secret process whereby he was resurrected symbolized those cultures by means of which man is able to overcome his lower nature, master his appetites, and give expression to the higher side of himself. The mysteries were organized for the purpose of assisting the struggling human creature to reawaken the spiritual powers which, surrounded by the flaming ring of lust and degeneracy, lay asleep within his soul. In other words, man was offered a way by which he could regain his lost estate. In the ancient world, nearly all the secret societies were philosophic and religious. During the medieval centuries, they were chiefly religious and political, although a few philosophic schools remained. In modern times, secret societies in the Occidental countries are largely political or fraternal, although in a few of them, as in Masonry, the ancient religious and philosophic principles still survive. Space prohibits a detailed discussion of the secret schools. There were literally scores of these ancient cults with branches in all parts of the Eastern and Western worlds. Some, such as those of Pythagoras and Hermeticists, show a decided Oriental influence, while Rosicrucians, according to their own proclamations, gained much of their wisdom from Arabian mystics. Although the mystery schools are usually associated with civilization, there is evidence that the most uncivilized people of prehistoric times had a knowledge of them. Natives of distant islands, many of the lowest forms of savagery, have mystic rituals and secret practices which, although primitive, are of a decided Masonic tinge. Part 2. The second installment of Manly P. Hall's chapter on the ancient mysteries details the Druidic mysteries of Britain and Gaul and their long-felt influence on the development of Masonic rites. Quote, "The original and primitive inhabitants of Britain at some remote period revived and reformed their national institutes. Their priest or instructor had hitherto been simply named Gwyd, but it was considered to have become necessary to divide this office between the national and superior priest, and another whose influence would be more limited. From henceforth, the former became Derwid, or Druid, or superior instructor, and the latter, Gowid, or Ovid, Ovit, subordinate instructor, and both went by the general name of Beard, or Bards, or teachers of wisdom. As the system matured and augmented, the Bardic order consisted of three classes: the Druids, Beardbraint, or Privileged Bards, and Ovits. See Samuel Merrick and Charles Smith, The Costume of the Original Inhabitants of the British Islands. The origin of the word Druid is under dispute. Max Mueller of the Oak Trees. He further draws attention to the fact that the forest gods and tree deities of the Greeks were called Dryads. Some believe the word to be of Teutonic origin, others ascribe it to the Welsh. A few trace it to Gaelic druid, which means a wise man or a sorcerer. In Sanskrit, the word dru means timber. At the time of Roman conquest, the druids were thoroughly ensconced in Britain and Gaul. Their power over the people was unquestioned, and there were instances in which armies, about to attack each other, sheathed their swords when ordered to do so by the white-robed Druids. No undertaking of great importance was scattered without the assistance of these patriarchs, who stood as mediators between the gods and men. The Druidic order is deservedly credited with having a deep understanding of nature and her laws. The Encyclopedia Britannica states that geography, physical science, natural theology, and astrology were their favorite studies. The Druids had a fundamental knowledge of medicine, especially the use of herbs and spices. Crude surgical instruments also have been found in England and Ireland. An odd treatise on early British medicine states that every practitioner was expected to have a garden or backyard for the growing of certain herbs necessary to his profession. Eliphas Levi, the celebrated transcendentalist, makes the following significant statement, quote, "The Druids were priests and physicians, curing by magnetism and charging amulets with their fluidic influence. Their universal remedies were mistletoe and serpent's eggs, because these substances attract the astral light in a special manner. The solemnity in which mistletoe was cut down drew upon this plant the popular confidence and rendered it powerfully magnetic. The progress of magnetism will someday reveal to us the absorbing properties of mistletoe. We shall then understand the secret of those spongy growths which drew the unused virtues of plants and become surcharged with tinctures and savors. Mushrooms, truffles, gall on trees, and the different kinds of mistletoe will be employed with understanding by medical science, which will be new because it is old. But one must not move quicker than science, which recedes that it may advance the further." End quote. Not only was the mistletoe sacred as symbolic of the universal medicine of Panchaea, or Panacea, but also because of the fact that it grew upon the oak tree. Through the symbol of the oak, the Druids worshipped the supreme deity. Therefore, anything growing upon that tree was sacred to him. At certain seasons, according to the positions of the sun, moon, and stars, the archdruid climbed the oak tree and cut the mistletoe with a golden sickle consecrated for that service. The parasitic growth was caught in white cloths provided for the purpose, lest it touch the earth and be polluted by terrestrial vibrations. Usually, a sacrifice of a white bull was made under the tree. The druids were initiates of a secret school that existed in their midst. This school, which closely resembled the Bacchic or Eleusinian mysteries of Greece or the Egyptian rites of Isis and Osiris, is justly designated the Druidic Mysteries. There has been much speculation concerning the secret wisdom that the Druids claimed to possess. Their secret teachings were never written but were communicated orally to specially prepared candidates. Robert Brown, 32nd degree, is of the opinion that the British priests secured their information from Tyrian and Phoenician navigators who, thousands of years before the Christian era, established colonies in Britain and Gaul while searching for tin. Thomas Maurice, in his Indian Antiquities, discourses at length on Phoenician, Carthaginian, and Greek expeditions to the British Isles for the purpose of procuring tin. Others are of the opinion that the mysteries, as celebrated by the Druids, were of Oriental origin, possibly Buddhistic. The proximity of the British Isles to the lost Atlantis may account for the sun worship, which plays an important part in the rituals of Druidism. According to Artemidorus, Ceres and Persephone were worshipped on the island close to Britain when the rites and ceremonies similar to those of Samothrace. There is no doubt that the Druidic pantheon includes a large number of Greek and Roman deities. This greatly amazed Caesar during his conquest of Britain and Gaul, and caused him to affirm that these tribes adored Mercury, Apollo, Mars, and Jupiter in a manner similar to that of the Latin countries. It is almost certain that the Druidic mysteries were not indigenous to Britain or Gaul, but migrated from one of the more ancient civilizations. The school of the Druids was divided into three distinct parts, and the secret teachings embodied therein are practically the same as the mysteries concealed under the allegories of Blue Lodge Masonry. The lowest of the three divisions was that of Ovid. This was an honorary degree, requiring no special purification or preparation. The Ovids dressed in green, the druidic color of learning, and were expected to know something about medicine, astronomy, poetry if possible, and sometimes music. An Ovid was an individual admitted to the druidic order because of his general excellence and superior knowledge concerning the problems of life. The second division was that of Bard. Its members were robed in sky blue to represent harmony and truth, and to them was assigned the labor of memorizing, at least in part, the 20,000 verses of druidic sacred poetry. They were often pictured with the primitive British or Irish harp, an instrument strung with human hair, and having as many strings as there were ribs on one side of the human body. These bards were often chosen as teachers of candidates seeking entrance into the druidic mysteries. Neophytes wore striped robes of blue, green, and white, these being the three sacred colors of the druidic order. The third division was that of druid. Its particular labor was to minister to the religious needs of the people. To reach this dignity, the candidate must first become a bard praint. The druids also dressed in white, symbolic of the purity and the color used by them to symbolize the sun. In order to reach the exalted position of archdruid, or spiritual head of the organization, it was necessary for a priest to pass through the six successive degrees of the druidic order. The members of the different degrees were differentiated by the colors of their sashes, for all of them wore robes of white. Some writers are of the opinion that the title of archdruid was hereditary, descending from father to son, but it is more probable that the honor was conferred by ballot election. Its recipient was chosen for his virtues and integrity from the most learned members of the higher druidic degrees. According to James Gardner, there were usually two archdruids in Britain, one residing on the Isle of Anglesey and the other on the Isle of Man. Presumably, there were others in Gaul. These dignitaries generally carried golden scepters and were crowned with wreaths of oak leaves, symbolic of their authority. The younger members of the druidic order were clean-shaven and modestly dressed, but the more aged had long gray beards and wore magnificent golden ornaments. The educational system of the Druids in Britain was superior to that of their colleagues on the continent, and consequently, many of the Gaelic youths were sent to the Druidic colleges in Britain for their philosophical instruction and training. Eliphas Levi states that the Druids lived in strict abstinence, studied the natural sciences, preserved the deepest secrecy, and admitted new members only after long probationary periods. Many of the priests of the order lived in buildings not unlike the monasteries of the modern world. They were associated in groups like ascetics of the Far East. Although celibacy was not demanded of them, few married. Many of the Druids retired from the world and lived as recluses in caves and rough stone houses or in little shacks built in the depths of the forest. Here, they prayed and meditated, emerging only to perform their religious duties. James Freeman Clark, in his 10 Great Religions, describes the beliefs of the Druids as follows, quote, "The Druids believed in three worlds, and in transmigration from one to the other, in a world above this in which happiness predominated, a world below of misery, and this present state. This transmigration was to punish and reward, and also to purify the soul. In the present world, said they, good and evil are so exactly balanced that man has the utmost freedom, and is able to choose or reject either. The Welsh triads tell us there are three objects of metempsychosis, to collect into the soul the properties of all being, to acquire a knowledge of all things, and to get power to conquer evil. There are also, they say, three kinds of knowledge. Knowledge of the nature of each thing, of its cause and its influence. There are three things which continually grow less, darkness, falsehood, and death. There are three which constantly increase, light, life, and truth." End quote. Like nearly all schools of the mysteries, the teachings of the Druids were divided into two distinct sections. The simpler, a moral code, was taught to all the people, while the deeper, esoteric doctrine was given only to initiated priests. To be admitted to the order, a candidate was required to be of good family and of high moral character. No important secrets were entrusted to him until he had been tempted in many ways, and his strengths of character severely tried. The Druids taught the people concerning the immortality of the soul. They believed in transmigration and apparently in reincarnation. They borrowed in one life, promising to pay back in the next. They believed in a purgatorial type of hell where they would be purged of their sins, afterward passing on to the happiness of unity with the gods. The Druids taught that all men would be saved, but that some must return to earth many times to learn the lessons of human life, and to overcome the inherent evil of their own natures. Before a candidate was entrusted with the secret doctrines of the Druids, he was bound with a vow of secrecy. These doctrines were imparted only in the depths of forests and in the darkness of caves. In these places, far from the haunts of men, the neophyte was instructed concerning the creation of the universe, the personalities of the gods, the laws of nature, the secrets of occult medicine, the mysteries of the celestial bodies, and the rudiments of magic and sorcery. The Druids had a great number of feast days. The new and full moon and the sixth day of the moon were sacred periods. It is believed that initiations took place only at the two solstices and the two equinoxes. At dawn of the 25th day of December, the birth of the sun god was celebrated. Secret teachings of the Druids are said by some to be tinctured with Pythagorean philosophy. The Druids had a Madonna, or Virgin Mother, with child in her arms, who was sacred to their mysteries. And their sun god was resurrected at the time of year corresponding to that at which modern Christians celebrate Easter. Both the cross and the serpent were sacred to the Druids, who made the former by cutting off all the branches of an oak tree and fastening one of them to the main trunk in the form of the letter T. This oaken cross became symbolic of their superior deity. They also worshipped the sun, moon, and stars. The moon received their special veneration. Caesar stated that Mercury was one of the chief deities of the Gauls. The Druids are believed to have worshipped Mercury under the similitude of a stone cube. They also had a great veneration for the nature spirits, fairies, gnomes, and the like, little creatures of the forest and rivers to whom many offerings were made. Describing the temples of the Druids, Charles Hecklethorne, and the secret societies of all ages and countries says, quote, their temples wherein the sacred fire was preserved were generally situate on eminences and in dense groves of oak, and assumed various forms, circular because a circle was the emblem of the universe. Oval in allusion to the mundane egg from which issued, according to the traditions of many nations, the universe, or, according to others, our first parents, serpentine, because a serpent was the symbol of Hu, the druidic Osiris, cruciform, because a cross is the emblem of regeneration, or winged to represent the motion of the divine spirit. Their chief deities were reducible to two, a male and a female, the great father and mother, Hu and Seridwin, distinguished by the same characteristics as belong to Osiris, Isis, Bacchus, or Ceres, or any other supreme god and goddess representing the two principles of all being, end quote. Godfrey Higgins states that Hu, the mighty, regarded as the first settler of Britain, came from a place which the Welsh triads call the Summer Country, the present site of Constantinople. Albert Pike says that the lost word of masonry is concealed in the name of the druid god Hu. The meager information extant concerning the secret initiations of the Druids indicates a decided similarity between the mystery school and the schools of Greece and Egypt. Hu, the sun god, was murdered and, after a number of strange ordeals and mystic rituals, was restored to life. There were 3 degrees of the Druidic mysteries, but few successfully passed them all. The candidate was buried in a coffin, as symbolic of the death of the sun god. The supreme test was, however, being sent out to sea in an open boat. While undergoing this ordeal, many lost their lives. Taliesin, an ancient scholar who passed through the mysteries, described the initiation of the open boat in Faber's Pagan Idolatry. The few who passed this third degree were said to have been born again, and were instructed in the secret and hidden truths which the druid priests had preserved from antiquity. From these initiates were chosen many of the dignitaries of the British religious and political world. For further details, see Faber's Pagan Idolatry, Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, and Godfrey Higgins' Celtic Druids. The third installment of Manly P. Hall's chapter on ancient mysteries investigates the connection between Freemasonry and the cryptic Roman rites of Mithras, their origin, their spread, and their impact, not only on Roman society, but on the very fabric of modern masonry. When the Persian mysteries immigrated into southern Europe, they were quickly assimilated by the Latin mind. The cult grew rapidly, especially among the Roman soldiery. And during the Roman wars of conquest, the teachings were carried by the legionaries to nearly all parts of Europe. So powerful did the cult of Mithras become that at least one Roman emperor was initiated into the order, which met in caverns under the city of Rome. Concerning the spread of this mystery school through different parts of Europe, C.W. King, in his Gnostics and Their Remains, says, quote, Mithraic bas-reliefs cut onto the faces of rocks on the stone tablets still abound in the countries formerly the western provinces of the Roman Empire. Many exist in Germany, still more in France, and in this island, Britain. They have been discovered on the line of the Picts Wall and the noted one at Bath, end quote. Alexander Wilder, in his Philosophy and Ethics of Zoroasters, states that Mithras is the Zend title for the sun, and he is supposed to dwell within the shining orb. Mithras has a male and a female aspect, though not himself androgynous. As Mithras, he is the ford of the sun, powerful and radiant, and most magnificent of the Yazatas. As Mithra, this deity represents the feminine principle. The mundane universe is recognized as her symbol. She represents nature as receptive and terrestrial, and as fruitful only when bathed in the glory of the solar orb. The Mithraic cult is a simplification of the more elaborate teachings of Zarathustra, or Zoroaster, and the Persian fire magician. According to the Persians, there coexisted in eternity 2 principles. The first of these, Ahura Mazda, or Ormuzd, was the spirit of good. From Ormuzd came forth a number of hierarchies and good and beautiful spirits, angels and archangels. The second of these eternal existing principles was called Ahiraman. He was also a pure and beautiful spirit, but he later rebelled against Ormuzd. Being jealous of his power did not occur, however, until after Ormuzd had created light, for previously Ahiraman had not been conscious of the existence of Ormuzd. Because of his jealousy and rebellion, Ahiraman became the spirit of evil. From himself, he individualized a host of destructive creatures to injure Ormuzd. When Ormuzd created the earth, Ahriman entered into its grosser elements. Whenever Ormuzd did a good deed, Ahriman placed the principle of evil within it. At last, when Ormuzd created the human race, Ahriman became incarnate in the lower nature of man, so that in each personality, the spirit of good and the spirit of evil struggle for control. For 3,000 years, Ormuzd ruled the celestial worlds with light and goodness. Then he created man. For another 3,000 years, he ruled man with wisdom and integrity. Then the power of Ahriman began, and the struggle for the soul of man continues through the next period of 3,000 years. During the fourth period of 3,000 years, the power of Ahriman will be destroyed. Good will return to the world again. Evil and death will be vanquished. At last, the spirit of evil will bow humbly before the throne of Ormuzd. While Ormuzd and Ahriman are struggling for control of the human soul and for supremacy in nature, Mithras, god of intelligence, stands as mediator between the two. Many authors have noted the similarity between Mercury and Mithras, as the chemical Mercury acts as a solvent, according to alchemists. So Mithras seeks to harmonize the two celestial opposites. There are many points of resemblance between Christianity and the cult of Mithras. One of the reasons for this probably is that the Persian mystics invaded Italy during the first century after Christ, and the early history of both cults was closely interwoven. The Encyclopedia Britannica makes the following statement concerning the Mithraic and Christian mysteries. Quote, "The fraternal and democratic spirit of the first communities and their humble origin, the identification of the object of adoration with light and the sun, the legends of the shepherds with their gift and adoration, the flood and the ark, the representation in art of the fiery chariot, the drawing of water from the rock, the use of bell and candle, holy water and the communion, the sanctification of Sunday and the 25th of December, the insistence on moral conduct, emphasis placed on abstinence and self-control, the doctrine of heaven and hell, primitive revelation of the mediation of the Logos emanating from the divine, the atoning sacrifice, the constant warfare between good and evil and the final triumph of the former, the immortality of the soul, the last judgment, the resurrection of the flesh, and the fiery destruction of the universe, are some of the resemblances which, whether real or only apparent, enabled Mithraism to prolong its resistance to Christianity." End quote. The rites of Mithras were performed in caves. Porphyry, in his Cave of the Nymphs, states that Zarathustra was the first to consecrate a cave to the worship of God, because a cavern was symbolic of the earth, with a lower world of darkness. John P. Lundy, in his Monumental Christianity, describes the Cave of Mithras as follows, quote, "But this cave was adorned with the signs of the zodiac, Cancer and Capricorn. The summer and winter solstices were chiefly conspicuous. As the gates of the souls descending into this life or passing out of it in their ascent to the gods, Cancer being the gate of descent and Capricorn of ascent. These are the two avenues of the immortals passing up and down from earth to heaven, and from heaven to earth." The so-called chair of St. Peter in Rome was believed to have been used in one of the pagan mysteries, possibly that of Mithras, in whose subterranean grottos the votaries of Christian mysteries met in the early days of their faith. In Anacalypsis, Godfrey Higgins writes that in 1662, while cleaning this sacred chair of Bar Jonas, the 12 labors of Hercules were discovered upon it, and that later the French discovered upon the same chair the Mohammedan Confession of Faith, written in Arabic. Initiation into the rites of Mithras, like initiation into many other ancient schools of philosophy, apparently consisted of three important degrees. Preparation for these degrees consisted of self-purification, the building up of the intellectual powers and the control of the animal nature. In the first degree, the candidate was given a crown upon the point of a sword and instructed in the mysteries of Mithras's hidden power. Probably, he was taught that the golden crown represented his own spiritual nature, which must be objectified and unfolded before he could truly glorify Mithras. For Mithras was his own soul, standing as mediator between Ormuzd, his spirit, and Ahriman, his animal nature. In the second degree, he was given the armor of intelligence and purity, and sent into the darkness of the subterranean pits to fight the beasts of lust, passion, and degeneracy. In the third degree, he was given a cape upon which were drawn or woven the signs of the zodiac and other astronomical symbols. After his initiation was over, he was hailed as one who had risen from the dead, was instructed in the secret teachings of the Persian mystics, and became a full-fledged member of the order. Candidates who successfully passed the Mithraic initiations were called lions and were marked upon their foreheads with the Egyptian cross. Mithras himself is often pictured with the head of a lion and two pair of wings. Throughout the entire ritual were repeated references to the birth of Mithras as the sun god, his sacrifice for man, his death that men might have eternal life, and lastly, his resurrection and the saving of all humanity by his intercession before the throne of Ormuzd. While the cult of Mithras did not reach philosophic heights attained by Zarathustra, its effect upon the civilization of the Western world was far-reaching, for at one time nearly all of Europe was converted to its doctrines. Rome, in her intercourse with other nations, inoculated them with her religious principles, and many later institutions have exhibited Mithraic culture. The reference to the lion and the grip in the lion's paw have a strong Mithraic tinge and may easily have originated from this cult. A ladder of seven rungs appears in the Mithraic initiation. Faber is of the opinion that this ladder was originally a pyramid of seven steps. It is possible that the Masonic ladder with seven rungs had its origin in this Mithraic symbol. Women were never permitted to enter the Mithraic order, but children of the male sex were initiates long before they reached maturity. The refusal to permit women to join the Masonic order may be based on the esoteric reason given in the secret instructions of the Mithraics. This cult is another excellent example of those secret societies whose legends are largely symbolic, representations of the sun and his journey through the houses of the heavens. Mithras rising from a stone is merely the sun rising over the horizon, or as the ancients supposed, out of the horizon, at the vernal equinox. John O'Neill disputes the theory that Mithras was intended as a solar deity. In The Night of the God, he writes, quote, "The Avestan Mithra, the Yazata of light, has 10,000 eyes, high, with full knowledge, strong, sleepless, and ever awake. The supreme god Ahura Mazda also has one eye, or else it is said that with his eye, the sun, moon, and stars, he sees everything." The theory that Mithra was originally a title of the supreme heavens god, putting the sun out of court, is the only one that answers all requirements. It will be evident that here we have origins in abundance of the Freemason's eye and its nunquam dormio. The reader must not confuse the Persian Mithra with the Vedic Mitra or Mitra. According to Alexander Wilder, the Mithraic rites superseded the mysteries of Bacchus and become the foundation of the Gnostic system which for many centuries prevailed in Asia, Egypt, and even the remote West. End quote. The most famous sculpturings and reliefs of this protocos show Mithras kneeling upon the recumbent form of a great bull, into whose throat he is driving a sword. The slaying of the bull signifies the rays of the sun, symbolized by the sword. Release at the vernal equinox the vital essence of the earth, the blood of the bull, which pouring from the wound made by the sun god fertilizes the seeds of living things. Dogs were held sacred to the cult of Mithras, being symbolic of sincerity and trustworthiness. The Mithraics used the serpent as an emblem of Ahriman, the spirit of evil, and water rats were held sacred to him. The bull is esoterically the constellation of Taurus. The serpent, its opposite in the zodiac, Scorpio, the sun, Mithras entering into the side of the bull, slays the celestial creature and nourishes the universe with its blood. Well, there you have this three-part series on the ancient mysteries and secret societies which have influenced modern Masonic symbolism, taken direct from a chapter of the same name in Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages. I hope you enjoyed this sort of philosophical, etheric look at this topic. As I mentioned, you need to take it with a grain of salt and that you would need to discern what you like from it. Certainly there are quotes by various people within this article, within this chapter, namely by Eliphas Levi, who has never had any kind of source material or anything. And even Hecklethorn, the writings of Hecklethorn are pretty awesome as well, but don't take everything for facts until you can verify them. Much like people say it's true because it was on the internet, the same is true for books. Just because it's in a book doesn't necessarily mean it's true. You do need to show your citations and all of those things. And so with some of this, that's just never going to happen. These are esoteric articles and chapters and books that we know people take poetic license with, and can't prove everything because a lot of this stuff is based on ancient knowledge, you know, passed down from many tomes of books that have all been gathered, and ostensibly the idea of putting its source materials together and showing this would be quite the endeavor. I mean, even taking one concept of some bit, if you took just the first sentence from one of these paragraphs, like, when Ormuzd created the earth, Ahriman entered into its grosser elements. If you wanted to, say, cite this particular statement and find not only what grosser elements means, probably greater elements, but what does that mean in terms of this whole story, you'd have to look through probably a bunch of different books to find out what exactly this means, and you'd have to cite each one of them. And that's just one sentence. So that's kind of what Manly Hall is really up to, and that seems like a daunting and uncompletable task. However, maybe, you know, OpenAI, you could tell it, hey, go through the entire text of Secret Teachings of All Ages and create citations for everything. I'm sure that's in the future. If it's not, maybe we can do it. In any case, that's it for this week. I hope you all had a wonderful week. I hope you had a meaningful Memorial Day. We'll end the show on that note. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Okay, you're up.